This episode of DLC is brought to you by Alienware Area 51 Laptops. A new era of power has arrived with the Alienware Area 51 gaming laptops. Intentionally engineered to push more power to the CPU and GPU for maximum performance. Combined with Intel Core Ultra 9 processors, merging CPU, NPU, and integrated GPU into one AI-optimized chip, it delivers fast, smart, seamless performance across everything you do. And with the new cryo chamber design, airflow is focused exactly where it's needed most. Fused with Alienware's enhanced thermal solutions, it creates a higher power output without raising noise levels, allowing you to play with confidence even during the most demanding marathon gaming sessions. So no matter what you're playing, Alienware ensures every game runs precisely as its developers intended. A new era of power is here. All you have to do is take it. Discover Area 51 today at www.alienware.com/area-51laptops. Oh yes, it is that time. Welcome to DLC, your downloadable content for the week. DLC delivered the way it's meant to be, completely free. And that's thanks to our sponsor this week, New Relic. They made that possible. DLC, of course, is the show all about gaming in its many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I am your host, Jeff Cannata, and I am joined by my co-host, slash friend, slash nemesis, or as I like to call him, my co-fremesis. The man who finished the Winter Olympics in Sochi without a single medal, Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Like many Americans, I left Sochi medalless.
Despite your ice dancing practicing that you've been doing.
A lot. At the top of the show, I just want to say, I want to reiterate what you closed the show with about thinking about what you put out into the world and making a better place. We are all guilty of saying stupid stuff. And this past week, if you follow me on Twitter, you know that I said some stupid stuff, heat of the moment stuff, and you can't take things back after you put them out there. All you can do is apologize and learn from your mistakes. So if you never make it to the end of the show, let me reiterate, take a minute before you hit that tweet or yell at that person or post that Facebook post and just think about the world that you are part of and the world that you are creating. And with that, hello, good to be here.
Well said. I will probably be saying some stupid stuff in this show. What does DLC stand for? Of course, it's your downloadable Cannata, your downloadable Christian. But this week, DLC also means dispensing lessons and counsel, because we've got one third of the greatest advice cast on the interwebs. My brother and me brother, and also Polygon's own, Mr. Justin McElroy, the expert video gamer and expert.
What a grand pleasure it is to be here. Dude, hello, gentlemen.
This is not exaggerating. I'm not blowing smoke. Honestly, when I was first talking to the 5x5 folks about doing this show, and we started talking about doing it over Skype, the first thought I had was, oh, awesome, I get to have Justin McElroy on the show. That was my first thought.
That's very flattering. Thank you, yeah. Jeff.
I love working with you. I'm a big fan of your stuff, and if people aren't listening to My Brother and Me, they are missing out on one of the funniest, most entertaining shows out there.
Jeff, that's so kind of you to say, but gosh, the Justin McElroy brand is such a broad umbrella. How does anyone choose a favorite of his many products and outputs? Is it the medical history podcast Sawbones? Is it his video game work at polygon.com? Is it his Twitter feed at Justin McElroy, McElroy? It's so hard to pick, but I think that's great that you're able to narrow it down to just one.
Is it his plugging? Is it his plugging ability? That's up there
is
at
it
the
his
top.
Plugging ability. Is it his guest role in True Detective Season 2? I mean, they're so.
You've already been cast, huh? You already got that. You already cast on the.
I'm going to be sort of a smaller but pivotal role, Dr. Spooky. is going to be my character's name.
Ironically, the comic relief Dr. Spooky is. He's not spooky at all. He's hilarious.
It's weird.
I was actually on Rake this week, if anybody saw that, for realsies.
I know. That's very exciting, Jeff. Congratulations.
Yeah, that's me plugging me.
What's Rake like in real life? That's what everybody wants to know.
How is he like in real life? I actually never met the lead on Rake. I only met Michael Imperioli, who was charming and as soprano-tastic as you could guess. But we are not going to talk about that stuff on this show. This is about video games. And of course, we start the show every week with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week.
That remix sent in by Patrick L. I've been calling him Patrick because he's from Sweden, and I assumed it was a weird pronunciation. But of course, it's just Patrick. So thanks, Patrick. Story of the Week is where we convince one another of what the most important story in video gaming was this week. I'd like to start, actually, just as a side note, because this happened right before we went on the air, and note the saddest story of the week, which is Harold Ramis passed away. Ugh. And, I mean, that guy really contributed so much to my childhood and who I am today. My sense of humor was formed. I mean, he, one of the Ghostbusters, but as a director and writer, he's responsible for Caddyshack and Groundhog Day. I mean, these are movies. Stripes, he was in Stripes. These are movies that really formed my comedic sensibility. So I just wanted to note that right at the top of the show.
Yeah, such a huge loss. And he had such a knack for bringing real intelligence and heart to what otherwise would have been pretty dumb comedy. So he will be missed.
Indeed. Anyway, but story of the week, guys, we got a lot of stuff happening this week. Justin, do you have a particular story that you think is the most important of the week?
There are so many options. I mean, I think it's hard to argue with Irrational Games being the biggest story of the last. I mean, if we're going just hard last 7 days, I mean, I think that's got to be the one, right?
Yeah, I mean, of course, everybody, this show is decided by listener contribution. You can submit stories of the week using hashtag DLCSOTW, DLC Story of the Week. And a bunch of people submitted this Irrational Games story, including at Adam Reinder, at Fist Grenade. This is a big story. This is Irrational Games, the guys responsible for Bioshock and Bioshock Infinite, Ken Levine's studio, which was 200-plus people strong, is now being downsized to 15 people and not going to be working on Bioshock franchise games in the future. Although that doesn't mean the end of Bioshock. Certainly 2K has an interest in keeping that franchise going strong. But it does mean that a lot of these people will have to find new jobs and they will be working on much smaller projects. Mm-hmm. So, Justin, why did you think that's a big deal?
Two reasons, and I saw a lot of people who were upset by some of the optimism at this news. So to be clear, this is two very different stories. On the one level, there is a very human story of people who are out of work, and that is obviously very sad and is unfortunate. But I think it's important to sort of delineate between the two because it's in two very different contexts for those people and how the story relates to them and to how it relates to people who buy games. I mean,
right.
I think that obviously – so obviously I should say first, for anyone who lost their job, I'm very sorry to hear so. And I think that the interesting thing about it is that it is a huge influx of talent into the marketplace. I mean – some of the best and brightest were sort of drawn in by Levine's sort of gravitational pull. There is going to be a lot of talent. I do not envy someone who is looking for a job in development right at this very moment because there are going to be a lot of good people who are available. I think as surprising as maybe the story was for some people, to me, it made a lot of sense because Levine is, has been heralded by a lot of people as an auteur, somebody who has a big vision and wants to actually say something with games. And I think the size of specifically BioShock Infinite, I think this was less of a problem in BioShock, but I think in the size of BioShock Infinite and the cost of that game required him to maybe make concessions in his game to make it appeal to a broader audience. And I think that left with an end product that was sort of neither here nor there, still wonderful in a lot of different ways, but maybe step back a bit from the vision or the message that Levine may have initially wanted to get across. So in looking forward to what's next for him, I think the idea of less of an expectation on return on an investment and more ability for him to sort of do the game, you know, the exact game that he wants, could make for something really interesting.
Boy, I agree with all of that. I think that, as you said, it's hard to talk about this and just strip away the human element of the fact that there's a bunch of people that lost their jobs. And, you know, we certainly don't want to seem callous and you know, disregard that element of the story because it's there. However, I don't think that's all that uncommon in the video game industry. You know, these studios rise and fall and they bloat up to create something and then they strip that away to create something smaller, and people are changing jobs all the time. So it's certainly not uncommon. It's certainly a higher profile here just because this is a pretty big name studio headed by a guy who's out in front in a lot of ways in the video game industry. But if you set that aside, I think you're right. You know, the BioShock Infinite behemoth of the, you know, the battleship that was plodding through the waters, it was hard to change direction on that thing. It was a big old cumbersome, you know, bloated kind of project that wasn't nimble and wasn't quick and couldn't turn on a dime. And I think you're absolutely right in pointing out that you can see that in that product. You can see the difference in what was promised to what was delivered. You can see where it seems like it was rushed to release. And that doesn't discount how great a game it was in a lot of ways, but it certainly is exciting to think that there may be smaller, more nimble products put out by some of these people, and we might get some really interesting projects out of this smaller version of Irrational. Christian, are you seeing it that way?
So I hope so. I mean, I wonder if you know, Mr. Levine is able to create these smaller, more nimble projects and have them come out. I mean, I certainly was in no way involved, and I have no inside information as to the production or development of BioShock Infinite. But, you know, guys from Epic were brought over, 2K sent people over. There were hirings towards the end of that project to have the project come out. And Ken seems like such an ideas guy. I wonder if there's, you know, a hard point between, you know, rubber hitting pavement or the game coming out, that if we'll see these small projects. I agree that I think it's very exciting, but then I also look at studios like Double Fine. And for me personally, very few of their smaller, when Tim Crino started Double Fine, they moved to the smaller downloadable title emphasis. Very few of those titles really excited me.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I mean, very few of them. Some of them I really love, but it's not like every time one comes out, I'm blown away by it. So how are you?
Well, there's
say
so many more though. That, I mean, if you think of what was the Jack Black game? I can never remember the name of it.
Brutal Legend.
Yeah, yep. Brutal Legend. You think that game was one game in how many years, and now they're able to put out multiple projects. They have so much more personality in life, I think, and they aren't encumbered by that. I don't know.
That's,
I mean,
that's the positive side of things, but I also don't necessarily believe that more is better. And I think if you know, Ken is able to make passion projects and have these really awesome projects come out, then I think there's merit to that. But I also don't think that just shooting a shotgun and, you know, sometimes I think distraction is the enemy. And, you know, you're able to do all these things, and what do I do? And, ooh, I'm going to do this for a little bit. Now I'm going to run over and do this for a little bit. I can do whatever I want. I can do this for a little bit, versus the hard work of buckling down, and I call it getting to the plateau. And I think any career or job has this, or even any project. You start on something, it's exciting and new, you get your team together, you're ramping through things, everything seems great, and then you hit that point where you need to work, right? And there aren't any immediate jumps, and you have to work towards a milestone that's far away. And sometimes, you know, doing that and getting through that, I think, often creates really, really great things that if you're a moth to a flame, you'll never get the Mona Lisa. You know, you'll never get that amazing finished project. And so I hope that Ken Levine is able to do some really amazing things. But, I'm never a fan of when a studio goes away that created things that I loved. So that's where I am on it.
It's interesting. The Schaefer comparison is really interesting because I think that the big difference between those two, and this is complete, you know, this is not based on intimate personal knowledge of either of those cats, but I think that Schaefer is a lot more willing to experiment and play and release something that's really interesting if it interests him and interests his team. I think that Levine is much more of a perfectionist, somebody who wants it, whatever the finished product is, to look exactly like what he has in his head. So it'll be interesting to see what his approach is like for a smaller team. I'm not sure we're going to see something like we've seen from Double Fine, where it's a steady stream of really interesting, but occasionally flawed games.
I think it seems to me the first guy that tried this was Jaffe, right? With, he went off and did that car game, Calling All Cars, I think it was called. And another one. Boy, I'm not doing good with titles today. My brain isn't working.
Twisted Metal, right? He made another
Twisted Metal. But I think there was something between those two, wasn't there? Anyway, but he was the sort of first guy, that big name creator out in front, very vocal guy, who said, no, I'm going to make these smaller projects for a little while. And I'm not so sure, even if you asked him, if he would say that was, it felt like a success for him, or at least was fulfilling in the way he wanted it to be. Interestingly, in the chat room, Toki Not a Bumblebee said, isn't that the way games in general are going? It seems like there's shovelware, AAA, and indie with a few mid-level titles. I'm not so sure that that's what this is. I don't think he's necessarily going indie. I don't think Irrational is now an indie, and it's certainly not shovelware. I think the idea is to create smaller AAA. I think the idea is to create these really high-profile games that are still, AAA, sort of the Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons. You know, that didn't come indie, but it was a smaller project that sort of was high profile at the same time. And hearing Levine talk about what he wants to do next, which is this narrative Lego idea where you have blocks of narrative that you can reassemble, that's pretty exciting stuff to me.
Yeah, I think it'll be cool if this leads to – I think what we're going to see more and more is sort of a middle tier, somewhere between indie and AAA, where you don't have the huge, huge, huge risk of AAA games, have a little larger scope than a traditional indie game.
Yeah. Remember, you can participate in the discussion as well. You can call in at 512-518-5714 if you're listening live. If you're downloading the show later and you want to participate in the future, remember we record the show live Mondays at 11 a.m. Pacific time at 5by5.tv/live. You can participate in the chat or call in 512-518-5714. Christian, what is your pick for Story of the Week?
So, I love a good new gadget coming out, and I love a good console launch. And to some extent, it's my biggest story of the week, almost for being a non-story for past console launches, is the PlayStation 4 is out in Japan. And I don't know if it's just because it came out so many months after the US got it, but to me, growing up as a gamer, right, that was always awesome. You'd get your Nintendo Power or your EGM or your Game Pro, and you'd look at the pictures of consoles in Japan and these crazy long lines and stores that you never understood with, mascots dressed up and people in line that look like adults. And you're like, yeah, mom and dad, adults play games or, whatever. And this, it came out. As far as I know, I haven't seen numbers yet.
But most of the time back then, Christian, it was because they got it there way before we got it here. And the tables have turned.
I know. That's what I'm saying. And that's why I think it's interesting. And this is, the 3DS did big business and had lines, but you know, more and more we're getting into the day and age where consoles are pre-ordered and ordered online, and like, you know, you and I on episodes of NLB, you know, we waited for the FedEx guy to come to your door, you know, to get the console. Yeah. It's not as if we're in line going, come on, come on, come on. And so it was just so interesting that a large Japanese company releases their next big, already internationally very successful console in their home country. And it seemed like the most anticlimactic launch of a console, of a major console that I can remember. And that's why I think it's such an interesting story, because here's this thing, and it's the first time that Japan, you know, gets to feel the 3 month later effect that we've got to deal with for so many console launches now.
Yeah, I think that it's not the story of the week because we don't know what it means yet. I think it might be the story next week or a few weeks from now when we actually get numbers and we kind of understand contextually how Japan relates to the rest of the world as far as people going out and buying PS4s. Right now, all we see is, like you said, you know, kind of fun video of people waiting in line. So in that sense, not the story of the week. I can watch people stand in line.
A major console comes out, it has to be at least nominated and given airtime as a story of the week. Whether or not it wins the story of the week is, you know, debatable. But Justin already brought up, you know, Irrational. And I think it's a big story. Now you can go ahead and pick your crappy little story and we'll pretend like it's the biggest because you're the main host of the show. And you know,
all right, Justin, what do you think about the PS4 launching in Japan? Is it a big deal?
I think it's good that they have it now because they didn't before. And now if you think about it, they do. So that's, I think that's great.
Even if you don't think about it, they still do.
Yeah, I hope they like it, and I hope they like all the games for it, and they enjoy it very much.
That sounds like Justin really agreed with me. Wow.
I think you're misreading that, Christian, but okay. You know, a bunch of people submitted, including at Dr. Dogbert, at DGB3, at Cheesecake Jones, this stuff about Xbox One and the Titanfall bundle, kind of coupled with the UK price drop. So I think this is a pretty big deal as far as kind of what we were talking about last week when Garnet was on the show talking about Xbox One. And it seems to be that Microsoft is worried about falling behind right away. And certainly in the UK, where PS4 seems to have a significant advantage sales-wise, dropping the price in the UK from beginning February 28th, which is a few days from now, it will drop from £429.99 to just under £400. And the console gets a bundle with Titanfall coming out in March. So this is in all territories, this is a clear attempt, I think, to bump those March sales figures up to show that Titanfall is a big deal and everybody wants it. And I think it's good for consumers. I think this is a big story.
I think it's a big story next week after we have numbers, because right now it's just a thing that's out there and there, you know, it's going to happen in the future. So who cares?
We stood up my own petard.
To me. I'm not an expert on your dynamic, but I don't know, guys. I think you got some beef you need to squash. Getting a lot of heat here.
All right, whose side are you on, Justin? This is the question.
Oh, God, don't make me choose sides. Yeah, I mean, I think it's telling. I mean, the problem with the UK is that Sony has it on lock. Like, Sony is the brand there. And I think that Microsoft has not proven a great track record with trying to build momentum in territories where it's not already very popular. I think that Xbox 360 in Japan is pretty indicative of that. Of course, they're two very different markets, but trying to make it a more tempting package makes sense. But in a way, I think Christian's right, because the impact of this all hangs on you know, how people in the UK gravitate towards it. I think it's interesting that it's not being spun as a price drop here, even though, I mean, it's certainly it's the same price plus a game, right, which I worry might rub some early adopters the wrong way. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if they just waited a little while, they could have gotten a free game.
Yeah, basically a $60 price drop, kind of covertly. I've been arguing this whole time that it doesn't really matter if Xbox falls behind early, just based on judging last generation when the PS3 was the early loser. And it still had a very healthy lifespan, had great games that came out for it. It didn't go away. It stuck around. It was great. It was a great console to own over the lifespan, the 7+ years of its life. And I think the same thing will be the case with these two consoles. In fact, I think that's the same thing with the Wii U as well. So for me, I've been arguing, who cares? But do you agree or disagree with that, Justin?
Who cares about what?
About who falls behind early. Like, clearly people at Microsoft care because they're really trying to prevent that from happening. But I don't think Xbox One is going anywhere. And I certainly don't think third parties are going to stop supporting it if it's number two instead of number one. I think that both consoles are selling very well and they both will have robust libraries. I don't know how much as a consumer it will impact me which console's number one, which console's number two.
Well, I think momentum is huge at this point. We've never seen two consoles launch two consoles that are in this close a parity. I mean, the Wii and PS3 launched within a couple weeks of each other, but those are very different systems. I think that we've never had, you know, the big two consoles launching this close to each other, and I think that it's a land grab right now. I mean, and once that momentum starts to build, it could be hard to deflate that head of steam. I mean, the story that I always refer to with this is you look at Xbox Live, and I think that a huge reason the 360 was as successful as it was just because it built up that online momentum of this is what my friends are playing on and never let it go. That was never diffused just because that was you bought a 360 because your friends were playing online on 360. A lot of people. And then when you buy the multi-platform game, which one are my friends going to be playing on? A lot of times the answer to that was 360. And once that snowball starts, it can be really hard to diffuse it. So I do think it's important to have this early momentum.
In your defense, Jeff, after, you know, joking earlier, we got both of us, and I tried to pull up, but I couldn't find him in my Twitter feed, so I apologize to this person. But you and I both were tweeted at, and after last week's show, someone saying that they work in retail and they personally sold 8 Xbox Ones just to get into the Titanfall. Like, people were wanting to get into the Titanfall beta. So, yeah. I mean, I think
Titanfall's
this bundle,
a system seller. Yeah.
I think, no, I don't, I still won't go that far.
No, I accept your apology.
Okay, good. I think this bundle will be a big one. And, you know, to Justin's point that early adopters got burned, yes, but at some point also, I feel like early adopters, you know, I'll say we, myself included, need to expect that. You know, you rush in on day one, it's never a quote unquote good deal, right?
Oh, let me clarify. I think that if you buy a system day one, you deserve, and again, including myself in this, you deserve whatever you get. Like, I wouldn't have told anybody to buy a console day one if you can avoid it, because this stuff is the best time to buy a console or any piece of technology really is 6 months after today. So 6 months from now is the best time to buy it. And if you ask me in 6 months, I'll say the exact same thing. Like, those deals, and they don't care if they rub you the wrong way. They already got your $500. They don't care.
Does anybody know if you walked into whatever store today and bought an Xbox One, would it say Day One Edition on it? Or do they have ones that don't have Day One Edition on them printed up?
I would imagine they've sold through a lot of that.
I saw one Day One Edition, because you can tell the box is black versus green for the Xbox Ones. I saw one Day One Edition, it was either 2 or 3 weeks ago at my local Target, but I don't see many.
All right. Well, I want to take a call and see what the audience who the audience agrees with as far as Story of the Week goes. But first, we do need to thank our sponsor, New Relic. New Relic is a software analytics company that helps make sense of billions of metrics across millions of applications, all in real time. One thing people are focused on this year is seamless application performance across multiple platforms on all of their devices. Which sounds simple, but making an app work consistently on lots of different devices, all with different operating systems, running different types of software, that's complex. How complex? Well, back in the old days, we're talking like 2007 here, it was basically impossible for an app developer to know how his or her app was performing once it got shipped to production. Back in those days, you'd spend a ton of time doing internal bug hunts and then eventually just cross your fingers and hope for the best. You'd sit around monitoring Twitter and app stores, trying to find out how well your apps were or were not performing. But thankfully, those days are now officially behind us. New Relic lets you track your application performance down to the end user level, all in real time. This means you can spot problems, find bugs, and fix your code fast, way before your users even notice anything is wrong. So go and check out New Relic. Go and check out New Relic by going to newrelic.com/DLC to learn more and use offer code DLC30. That will give you a special 30-day extended free pro trial available exclusively to the listeners of DLC. New Relic has been with us from the beginning. We really appreciate their support. And if you want to support the show, why not visit newrelic.com/DLC and check it out. newrelic.com/DLC and use promo code DLC30 for that 30-day extended free pro trial. All right, let's take a call and find out who agrees with whom. All right, I'm seeing a call from 574 area code. Hello?
Hello?
Who has got the right story of the week? Which one strikes your fancy?
Man, I gotta say, I think irrational closing is the story of the week, but all the negatives, nobody said anything about they're going out there and having a career fair and trying to help people find work. I think that's a really great thing that they're doing in the midst of a tough decision.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think it's nice to see that. It's nice to see that it's not a big giant corporate screw you and, you know, don't let the door hit you on the way out. But it doesn't change the fact that, you know, 180 plus people are being fired. So, you know, it's kind of the least they can do.
But do you think, you know, layoffs, unfortunately, are a fairly regular occurrence in the games industry after large projects come out and, you know, the DLC, the final single-player story DLC for Infinite is, you know, done or soon to be done and almost out. You know, would these layoffs have happened regardless? Like, I don't think this was Ken laying people off. He didn't own the studio, and it's unfortunate and tragic and horrible. It always is when people lose their jobs. But I wonder, had Irrational continued, you know, what amount of layoffs would have happened regardless of that, and just as they geared up for the next project versus this situation happening.
Yeah.
The other thing that's tough about it, we didn't mention it before, but to this point, I mean, they are in an area where there is certainly game development in the Boston region, but it is not there is not the breadth of options that you would have in a lot of areas. There are not going to be as many options for you if you don't want to relocate as somebody who is maybe in a different location.
Yeah. I got another caller on the line from 661 area code. How do you feel about these stories of the week? Which one do you think is the most important?
Hi, this is Michael from Amsterdam.
Hello.
I'm thinking it is the irrational one. I was actually pretty shocked when I saw the news happen. And I was like, well, this is completely from left field. On one hand, I do understand why Ken Levine would want to go smaller. On the other hand, I'm actually quite surprised that they let him do this, because Bioshock Infinite was the talk of the town, and it, in my opinion, it actually sold really well. I actually played it. I really enjoyed it a lot. But yeah, to see them go like that, it's kind of really disappointing, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think we haven't seen the last of Bioshock games. And I'm actually one of the few people I know that really liked BioShock 2.
BioShock 2 is great.
Oh, there you go. Justin agrees with me.
You are correct in this opinion.
Validation. But so I don't think having Levine part of the formula is required to make a good BioShock game. I think we'll see BioShock games. And I think this also speaks a lot to the fact that while he is one of the biggest names in video games, I would guess that the vast majority of the people that played BioShock or BioShock Infinite have no idea who he is, have never heard the name, and don't care. And the fact that the video game industry works the way it does still, in that designers aren't front and center, you don't get that kind of name recognition to the average consumer, I think 2K doesn't really care all that much as far as, you know, they're going to get more BioShock games, and that's the most important part. The big name on the box starts with a B. So, I don't know.
And there's also no reason to think that, and I think he maybe even intimated as much in his writing about it, but this is probably not a scenario where 2K allowed him to do this. It was probably closer to this is what he decided he wanted to do, and they could either keep him on to do it or not. I mean, he had enough leverage after BioShock that he wouldn't have needed to agree to a deal he couldn't have gotten out of had it needed to.
Yeah. That was very cool. That was our first call from Amsterdam. So that was awesome. I have another couple of stories I want to throw into the mix here just because they tickled my fancy. Of course, several people, including at Yankee Hotel, at Gas Weinhardt, submitted this Netflix pays Comcast story, which isn't technically video games, but it certainly has implications for us and the media we consume. This, you know, harkens back to all the net neutrality stuff we've been talking about over past weeks. It came through the pike that Netflix is going to pony up and actually give cash money to Comcast, who is almost going to be Comcast / Time Warner if that deal happens, to make sure that Comcast doesn't throttle Netflix, which it's pretty clear they've been doing. There's a lot of evidence. If you search around the web, there's a lot of people who've done pretty interesting tests over Comcast to find out that Netflix streaming has been being throttled. And this feels a little bit like extortion on Comcast's part to me. And the fact that Netflix is willing to say, yeah, we'll give you some money to make sure users, end users, get a good experience using our service is pretty frightening, especially when it seems like it's going to lead to higher prices down the line for Netflix. If they keep having to pay all these different providers to make sure you can watch Netflix, scary to me.
Did you see the Utnet update on this, Jeff? And Justin, if you know more, you know, feel free to let me know. I was on the road this past weekend, so I'm sure I missed some of it. But I think my understanding of it now is that Netflix for a while has been trying to get basically just, and I don't understand the way the internet works. I just know that Al Gore invented it, and to him I am grateful. I think they were trying to get access directly to Comcast's basically pipeline or feeds to people, and Comcast had been denying that. But I guess like Google and YouTube had already been doing that, had arrangements for that, and Netflix had been using a third party provider.
You said fart.
I said farty, yeah. To try to get in there, and now what this deal is, it's not according to Comcast, but I don't know if I trust them. This isn't a net neutrality thing. This is just them saying, okay, you can come directly into our hub or network and, you know, put your content out that way versus coming in through some other company that owns a thing that then gets access and comes through. So if a listener that made any sense to anyone or someone knows more about that, please let us know. But that's my understanding of what happened. Like all these stories, like in today's day and age, were quick to go up and it's like Netflix pays Comcast. And then, you know, 2 hours later, the story was updated. But of course, an updated story doesn't get bumped up in a page with the actual information. So I don't know if it's as scary as the initial stories made it sound.
Well, I think the end result of that is let's move on. Okay, let's go back to video games because there's a couple of cool games that are kind of sideways announcements for them, which is One, there's a new Tony Hawk game coming from Activision, which is funny because we were just talking about this a couple of weeks ago with Ollie coming out and how Tony Hawk games used to be awesome and then they were terrible and then they were gone. But it sounds like there's going to be a new Tony Hawk game coming. So there's that. There's this sort of tacit admission that Doom is happening from id, because if you buy Wolfenstein New Order, you get a beta code for the next Doom game, although it's not going to happen when you actually get Wolfenstein New Order. It's going to happen someday down the line in the future, eventually.
Was there a Tom Clancy Rainbow Six beta thing that was supposed to be with a game that never came out also? Like, these future beta promises, I think there was, right? Didn't it? Was it a Splinter Cell or for the next Tom Clancy Rainbow Six game that has now gone back to the drawing board again? Wasn't that packaged as a pre-order bonus or something for some game, and it still never happened?
Possibly.
Am I making that up?
You might be. I do remember the awesome Rainbow Six video that debuted, and everybody was salivating over, and it's like, oh, that's not anything, actually. And then the third of these, the trifecta of kind of weird pseudo announcements, is the Last of Us sequel being a 50-50 chance, which is a quote from Neil Druckmann to Reddit saying that if you're asking about a sequel right now, I'd say it's 50-50. And then he later commented that a new release featuring Joel and Ellie will only be made if it doesn't repeat what we've done but somehow builds on the original. I hate to be the cynical guy, because I try to not be, but when I finished The Last of Us, the first thing I thought was, well, there's a sequel. So anybody want to pick one of these three and tell me which one they're excited about or not excited about? Justin, what do you think?
Man, I just feel like Last of Us was – the story was so well told that I kind of hate the idea of – I mean, obviously, if there's, like they said, a compelling reason for continuing their story, then I'm all for it. But I just hate this sort of knee-jerk reaction from people that, like, hey, do it again because I want more of it. Yeah. I think it is harmful for people who just want a nice self-contained narrative that has something to say and has a point. I also didn't think when you strip away Joel and Ellie and their story, I mean, I don't think there's things in Last of Us that are sort of really important to return to. I mean, I don't know.
I completely agree with that.
Like, I mean, brace yourself for the visceral thrill of pushing a floating pallet around again, because strap in. When you remove the story from Last of Us, pretty much all the trappings are already feeling pretty dated. I mean, we're feeling pretty dated when the game released. So I'm not like super duper interested in doing it again.
As long as I can find parts of scissors, I'll know it's a sequel to The Last of Us.
Did either of you naysayers play the DLC?
No, I'm really interested to hear what you think about it. I don't know if Justin has, but I have not.
It's so good. And I'm a huge fan of The Last of Us. And that was, you know, one of my favorite game experiences ever. And the DLC I thought was so incredible in the way that, you know, if you played The Last of Us and paid just a little bit of attention to the story, you know what happens in the DLC. It's not as if, you know, it's spoiled if I were to say what happened. I'm not going to, just because I think the way the story is presented is so amazing. But it's really good. And until that, I didn't think that I really needed or wanted a sequel. But just whatever they decide to do in that world, I trust that, until I'm disappointed, I trust that it will be a rich and good experience. And I think that's where it's the 50-50 quote. One, you know, I think that's a smart answer to give, instead of saying we're definitely not going to make one, and then 2 years later they make one, that just seems dumb. Or to say we're definitely making one when they haven't started one or have anything to show, why say that? But I also think it's, they'll tell a story if there's a story to be told. And I think if they look at Joel and Ellie and say, you know, there's nothing really to tell here that doesn't seem trite, they won't do it. Or they'll find new characters in that world. But if you have $15 disposable income and, you know, you don't mind a quote-unquote shorter gameplay experience. I think it took me about 3 hours, but I spent a lot of time in each environment. And you still have your PS3 hooked up. it's really good. And for me, it was just a joy to go back to that world. And Justin, to your point about, you know, stripping away the story, the gameplay mechanics are tired. I mean, I agree, but I also think that's a dismissive way to look at a game. That's like the inverse of that is, well, if you took away the play mechanics of Pac-Man, man, that game story does not hold up. Or if you took away the...
You're saying it's all story.
Exactly. Well, I'm saying that's what you go to the game for. And, you know, the play mechanics, in my experience, didn't hinder the playing of that story or that narrative, and it made it seem compelling. It wasn't trying to be a Morrowind where you're the guy and you create your own story. It's like, here's a story to tell, and you acting out those actions and going through those experiences made it feel more powerful. And I think if you strip away the best part of a game, then other parts of the game look lesser.
I don't disagree. What I was saying is that I feel like Joel and Ellie's story was wrapped up really nicely. And so if you remove them from the equation, I don't know what people want more of. Like, I don't know that there's a lot more I don't know what aside from that people are wanting a return to, I guess, or what I would want to return to, I guess is what I was saying.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I agree with that. When people are like, well, do a Last of Us sequel and just have new characters in that same world. I'm like, well, but the world isn't particularly interesting. It's those characters that make the world interesting. But let's take a call and find out what others think. I have a call from 8850 area code. What would make you more excited? A new Last of Us, a new Doom, or a new Tony Hawk game?
To be honest, neither of those three. The last Doom was Doom 3, wasn't that good. The last Tony Hawk wasn't that good. And frankly, I never had a PS3, so I never played The Last of Us. So I don't really know what to think about that.
Wow. All right. So whose Story of the Week contender do you think was the most important?
I would say I think everyone pretty much agrees on this one. It's the irrational story. And let's be honest, like a lot of people talk about, oh, medium tier games that existed. It was Midway and THQ. They just didn't adopt digital distribution fast enough.
That's actually a really good point. I think you're right. I think that, the market changed and made these mid-tier games, not the games you run out to the store and pay $60 for. We needed variable pricing faster. And I think the indie side adopted variable pricing in a much better way, and that and digital downloads happened in that space faster. And I think that's a lot of the reason for the growth of the indie scene, at least on the PC side. Everybody agrees with me. I will take that as an everybody agrees with me. Okay, let's take another call. We've got 609 on the phone. Tony Hawk game, Doom game, or Last of Us sequel? Which you have to pick one. There's no squirming. What are you going
to
do?
I would like to talk about the Last of Us, and honestly, I don't think that a sequel is something I'd really like. If something like Inception has an interesting world I'd like to see new characters in, but the Last of Us, like you said, it doesn't have that interesting of a world. I think the Left Behind DLC is the perfect move for Naughty Dog to do in terms of the Last of Us, except for making more games, because Naughty Dog makes the best games ever, in my opinion. But I haven't tried the DLC yet, but I'm really excited for them to delve back into this. These character stories.
So not interested in Doom, huh? Nobody cares about Doom anymore? Is that not a big deal? That's not going to sell any Wolfenstein New Order copies?
Are you excited about new Doom? I mean, id is, I feel like, name only at this point, right? I mean, and when was the last id game that got you, Jeff, really excited?
Rage. I believe the last id game.
Did that get you excited after playing it or at E3 Vertical Slice? Really?
I know. I went on the Gamers with Jobs podcast and raved about Rage when I played it early before those guys had. I loved that game.
Listen, Kanata, I love your optimism shtick as much as the next guy, but you gotta know when to say when.
All right, tell me why Raid was terrible.
Just the game parts where you played it. <The game part. laughs> No, I did the review of Rage, and I think I think there were a lot of really cool ideas that just they didn't have the speed to iterate on, and get out ahead of. I guess was the problem that I had with Rage. There were some very good ideas that just during the development of it were done better other places, and by the time it was released, it didn't have a lot that I thought was particularly interesting about it.
All right, well, point taken. But I think a Doom could be cool. I think a really cool-looking new Doom.
So what is Doom then, Jeff? Define for us and the listeners what you think Doom is. Like, what is a Doom game, and what would a Doom sequel be? Because to me, a new Doom is about as exciting as a new Pitfall. It's a game that I loved when I was little. I would love a new Pitfall. No, why? You don't. You don't want that. you don't want it. What is Doom to you, and what would be an exciting new Doom other than just pretty, 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 pretty kind of slimy looking guys?
Well, we're gonna talk about Strider in a second, and I would say if you made Pitfall like they made Strider, I'm in. But that's neither here nor there. To your question, I think Doom is awesome graphics, demons, blasting stuff, and I think that it can be scary, it can be atmospheric. And yeah, a lot of games are doing that, and a lot of games are more sophisticated and more interesting. But if you made a Doom that's just a kick-ass first-person shooter, sort of what the People Can Fly guys were doing, it just made like a sort of, it's not trying to be a thousand things, it's just trying to be one thing, and that is blast demons and look great and kind of scare me a couple of times, I'd be into that. I'd be into that. I think that'd be cool.
That sounds to me like a Call of War as $15, $20 Far Cry Blood Dragon type game versus, I just don't know if that game warrants a $60 full production. I think people will complain that it's linear, that there's no story to drive the pace, that the gameplay becomes repetitive, but all those things are what Doom is. And then if you created like a, an Oblivion, that's not what you want out of Doom, or adding RPG mechanics to a Doom, like leveling up your guy as you go to build the BFG.
You're now even doomier than before.
I don't think that's what Doom is either. I think
Jeff 500 in the chat room said the Oculus Rift Doom would be the best way to revive it.
You don't get to bring up yourself what you type in the chat, Jeff.
There's only 499 other versions of me in here. Justin, you clearly agree with Christian that I'm crazy for wanting more Doom.
I've just never enjoyed Doom very much. It's just never really been my bag.
Justin's just trying to get on at midnight via the chat right now.
I'm just trying to rally my forces. I mean, I just want to give the people what they want. I don't know. I want to withhold judgment until we get a better idea of what that means. I mean, if you want to say Doom, I mean, that's such a wide. All we know is that it would probably be called Doom. Like, it's such a wide palette. They can do something interesting in. I agree with you, Christian, though, that like following that, the sort of model that's been created for what a Doom game is would be disastrous at a $60 price point. I want to see if they have a big idea, quote unquote, that would sell it.
All right. So, and nobody cares about Tony Hawk anymore either. We don't want to return to form for that series. Bunch of bah humbugs on this show today.
I can get down with a Tony Hawk game. It's like, here's the problem with I guess with all of these, right? Like when you took your brand and just brutalized it to a point where it's on life support, and someone's like, well, we're gonna wake it up, but the problem is when we take it off life support and we bring it out of this coma, it'll either be the thing that you loved or it'll be a vegetable, and we have no way of knowing one way or the other. And it's like, well, that's kind of hard to get pumped about because it's not as though the Tony Hawk name has just been lying dormant since its last great iteration. I mean, it's been lying dormant since someone made a plastic skateboard and challenged America to try to have fun with it. And America declined to take up that mantle.
So what you're saying is Tony Hawk is either hand plant or eggplant. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Exactly. That's exactly right. I hope that they would do that well. They just don't have the – it's not like it went out on a high note like another series that deserves to be revamp, like say a Colony Wars, for example, like that, that would get me pumped because that went out well. Yeah. But not, I can't neither get excited nor depressed about Tony Hawk until I have some idea of what they want to do with it.
I think the time for Tony Hawk isn't the cultural icon he once was. Skateboarding isn't the cultural phenomenon that it once was. You know, I think in terms of extreme sports games, you know, I know EA already tried with one SSX, but I think another SSX could be good and come out and capture gamer mind share before Tony Hawk could. I think Tony Hawk is long in the tooth, in the vein that way Madden, you know, people don't know Madden as a coach, a Super Bowl winning coach and coach of the Raiders. He's just a name on a box. And I don't think Tony Hawk has that cachet to sell games, nor do I think that that original style of game, again, would work in today's gaming market, unfortunately.
All right, well, let's put the story of the week to bed and move on to some of the stuff we've been playing. Justin, have you been playing anything you want to talk about?
I've been playing South Park, but that's for review, so I can't talk about it.
Oh, I'm so jealous. God. Can't wait for that.
Other than that, I was playing... Oh, God, this is so embarrassing. I don't have a lot of stuff that I've been playing, or at least things that like don't leap into my head. I played a game on iOS called Calculords. Have you guys heard of Calculords?
All the... All the fun of a calculator mixed with Tracy Lords? Is that what it is?
No, close. Okay. Right. Calculators is a game made by Sean Baby, if you are familiar with his work.
Animals?
So it's sort of a card game. The mechanics are based around cards. You have three lanes down which you're sending minions, and they're trying to get to the other side of the board where your enemy is, and they are also sending out minions, and they're battling. When your minions meet in one of the three lanes, they're battling against each other. But the really interesting thing about it is that your cards have a value, a numerical value attached to each of them. And each time you start a turn, you get 9 different
cards. Did we lose him? What happened?
That is
that was creepy.
The most tantalizing.
I was like,
tease.
He's going to hold this pause.
Okay,
for
where did
so
it
come? Long?
Where did I lose you? Because
you were agreeing with me that PS4 coming out in Japan was the story of the week. So we'll just take it from there. And
so my
go.
Call dropped in an alternate universe.
No, you were saying that you get a hand of cards.
Okay, so you get a hand of cards, yeah. And each one has a numerical value that you use to deploy one of your minions, right? But next to those cards, you have 9 different numbers, and next to there is a plus, minus, and a multiply sign. So in order to play a card, one of your minions, I should say, you have to create its total by adding – subtracting or multiplying your numbers. So, for instance, if you have a minion that has 42, right? 42 is the number on that card. You have to somehow create 42 out of the numbers to the right. So, you know, if you have a 4 and you have a 2 and a 7, you would do 4 plus 2 times 7, and that would give you numbers that you needed to to play the card, right?
Math,
right? So, The thing is, though, you get a bonus if you can use all of the numbers in one turn. So the strategy is both like figuring out where – what minion you want to play at what time, but also how can you use all of the numbers that you have available to you in a single turn so you get the bonus to deploy an extra minion. So it's half strategy and – this really weird math component. I should add as a corollary to my update on it that I am terrible at it because I am not smart enough to do it, to play it very well.
I'm going
to
try that. I've been so obsessed with threes lately. I'm used to playing numbers in games, so I need a break from that game anyway. It's wasting my life on that.
That's a weird one, right? Because you don't feel like you get any better at it. I'm a smart man.
I know.
I should be able to get better at this game by playing it repeatedly, but that does not.
There's a considerable amount of luck in that game. There's a considerable amount of luck because you literally can't plan too far ahead in that game. So, you know, you got to just get lucky and like, oh, that happened to come up.
And a lot of Hearthstone, but who wants to hear about
that? Oh, we could do a whole show about Hearthstone and then Christian wouldn't even need to be present. Well, I want to talk about Strider because I've been playing that a lot this week. Did you try that, Christian?
I played Strider. I forgot. That was the other thing. Strider.
Pretty great, right? Pretty fun.
I like it.
Stab. The idea of taking Strider, which honestly, one of my favorite old arcade games from when I was a kid. It was at the 7-Eleven by my house, and I used to ride my bike there every day and, you know, scrounge up a couple of quarters, and I loved it. Just the style of Strider was so enrapturing for me when I was a kid. So taking that and then making it a Metroidvania is inspired. I think that's the perfect way to revitalize that game. Instead of making it a linear, you know, left to right game, you're back going back and forth. You're getting power ups that let you access new areas. I mean, the difficulty level is pretty good on this game. This is no slouch as far as giving you enemies that can kick your butt. But it looks great. I'm playing it on Xbox One just because I had some extra cash, extra Xbox bucks to burn. But I'm digging it, man. It is really, really cool.
I have not played it a lot.
Anything to add, Justin?
That's a pretty good example of like a mid-tier game, right? I mean, it's certainly not as small in scope as a typical, you know, as an Xbox Live arcade title used to be. But it certainly is offering a lot for its price tag. I think it's a really smart approach to revitalizing a franchise.
Yes.
I sneezed there in the middle, so I turned down my knob real fast.
That's coming soon exclusively to Amazon Games, right?
Yeah, right.
Another good game from Double Helix.
Yeah, the other game that I've been playing this week, I got as a code from the publisher, and that is 99 Levels to Hell, which is on Steam and is another in this growing in popularity genre of roguelikes that you know, are punishing and brutal, but also random and crazy and fun and platformy. This one is very similar to Spelunky or Rogue Legacy or the games that I really dig, but adds that dual stick shooter element to it. So you're running around on a 2D sort of Lode Runner-esque plane, digging through different types of material to create paths for yourself. But you got yourself a shooty weapon, and you can aim that shooty weapon wherever you want with the other stick. I'm playing on PC with a controller, but I'm sure the mouse would do just fine as well. Anyway, so that's the sort of new hook that game adds to the mix, and it's pretty cool. It's really fun. It's got that same addictive, how far can you get down the 99 levels to hell, getting power-ups, spending money. It's got a fun sense of humor. For example, when you go into a store, the little guy in there is the dude from Clerks, and he says, like, I'm not even supposed to be here today. You know, it's like a fun little reference. And it looks really nice. It's got some really, I think, pretty graphics. And it's fun. It's going to scratch that itch if you're into those roguelikes. I've been playing it. It's one of those games where I sit down to try it out for 10 minutes and 2 hours go by, and it's like, oh, I'm still playing. Oh, yeah, it's because I haven't died and I keep wanting to keep going further. And, you know, if you kill 7 dudes on this level, you'll get the extended challenge, and collect, you know, 8 pieces of cheese on this level and you get the extended challenge. And so it's constantly got those carrots on sticks. So it's pretty good. And I think it's pretty inexpensive, although I did not buy it. Christian, you already talked about your Left Behind. Anything else you want to add?
It's a wonderful experience. If you're a fan of The Last of Us and you have the disposable income, definitely give it a try. I think what's so wonderful about it is because, you know, the story, the outcome of that episode is already known to you. At least for me, I was able to spend more time just kind of, I wanted to consume everything. And so each little environment you get in, you can, you know, look for clues, or of course the letters that people have left behind, and then objects that you can interact with in the environment. And it's just fun to know. It's like the way I pictured the Star Wars prequels being, right? Where it's like, you know what happens, and then you get to watch something before it, so you appreciate those kind of cute winks and nods to what might happen, or the character saying something like, I'll never fly in space. And you're like, yes, you will, C-3PO. Yes, you will. And I think it does it does that kind of stuff really well. That makes it a joy. And the writing and the voice acting is, you know, on par with The Last of Us and the best work that Naughty Dog has done. And it's really good. It's short, but doesn't feel too short. It's not like it ended and you're like, oh, that's how it ends. It feels complete. And it's really a joy to play. If you liked The Last of Us, I recommend it.
Cool. I have to apologize to the folks on the phone. I think we may have lost the Ansible, but hopefully we'll get that back and be able to take some more calls before the end of the show. Let's go right to tabletop time. Tabletop time! This is a very special week, actually, for tabletop time. Tabletop time! Because... We had Christian play a game, a board game. Justin, are you into board games? Do we have Justin? Did we lose him?
I'm still here. And you forced me to play a board game.
Oh, well, that's good. It's a massacre on the line today for some reason. So this is perfect because this is what I've been wanting to have happen for weeks and weeks. I had a board game night over my house. Garnet came over. You came over. Our friend Rob came over. And, you know, one of the big things that I always tell people who are into board games and want to get their friends into board games is you got to be... Ooh. I wonder if everybody can hear that.
You got to be cool. You got to be calm. You
got to
be
message.
Wiser.
Anyway, you got to be sensitive to what they want to play. You know, you got to kind of cater your night around, you know, you don't want to scare people off by introducing them into something super nuts right away. So I thought the perfect game to introduce you guys, we've been talking about worker placement games the last couple of weeks, and I've been talking about Euros and my love for Euro board games. I thought the perfect starter Euro would be Lords of Waterdeep. So that's the game that we started. Well, we started with a little game of Coup, which you can talk about as well. But Christian, I want to hear your take on Lords of Waterdeep, which I think is a great starter Euro, worker placement game, building buildings, filling out your sending off people into missions and completing quests to score points.
So I really enjoyed playing this game. I got second place, so I'm not just saying I enjoyed it because I won. I think what I like about it is time between turns isn't too prolonged, even though I know, Jeff, you were getting frustrated with me sometimes, but I was thinking it through, dude.
No, I like it.
And
I wasn't frustrated. I just want to, you know, I'm just trying to keep the games going. That's all I'm
right.
saying.
But there could only be so long between periods in which you talk, and then if it's been too long, you need to talk again. I understand. There you go. That's your period of talk. No, it's fun, and I think what I like about it is, like I said, the time between turns isn't too long, and it's... Every player, you feel like you're in it throughout the game. And you can, I don't want to get into the nitty gritty of the rules because people have said board game talks always just divert into here's how the rule set is. But it's exciting because at every stage within the game, you think that you might be able to win or pull it out in the end. And games like that, to me, are so much more fun to play versus Monopoly. I know that's a different style of game, but right. A game
it's
where.
It's a terrible game.
It is a terrible game. When someone can get in it and control. You know, vast parts or get key real estate on the board and the game's kind of over and then you're slogging through two more hours of game. You don't have a chance of winning. This game, Lords of Waterdeep, is that it?
That's right.
It's from
Wizards of the Coast, the guys that make Dungeons & Dragons, and it is a Dungeons & Dragons themed game.
Yeah, and name only, I feel like. That branding doesn't add anything to the game, right? There's not a dungeon master. There's not. They use archetypes from the D&D universe, but I don't think
location names and specific characters that if you're into the D&D lore, you would recognize. But yeah, you're right.
Right. But it's fun because at the end of the game, you know, you'll tally up some bonuses and that can swing the game big time. And you can be doing something in secret that will only show up at the end of the game, or other people have to keep a keen eye on players to see if they're doing that. That can, again, swing the game at the end. So it's competitive throughout. It's fun. It's fast moving. And it's not overly complex, which I enjoy, especially if you're hosting a board game night and trying to get new people into games. It's a game that, you know, you can play a full round of this game and have it be a full fun experience versus some games where it's like, we'll play 20 minutes and you'll figure out the rules and then you'll want to reset the game because you'll have messed up so badly in that first 20 minutes that we'll need to reset the board. So yeah, I think it, like you said, it's a great intro Euro game, and it's what, 4 to 3 to 8 players or something like that. We play
it's not 4. I think it's up to 5 players.
Okay.
But yeah, it's one of the things I love most about it is because it's from Wizards of the Coast and they have, you know, means and budget, the component quality is very, very high. And I particularly like the art direction of the game. It's beautifully designed as far as every single thing that you need to know on the board is displayed in front of you. And everything has got a place to land. There's a spot on the board for where you put your discards, and there's a spot on the board for where each building is built. And there's awesome little tokens that each player gets of their color, so that when you build a building, you get to attach your token. It fits right into a cool little slot in the corner, so you know I own that building. And when people use that building, they give me resources. It's everything makes sense. Everything fits together really well. It's beautiful. That goes a long way to making it an easy recommendation, but also the gameplay is fun. And it really is that Euro style game where you are just moving bits from one thing to another, compiling groupings of different colored bits, exchanging those different colored bits in for points, which is really the mainstay of what Euro games are. But with that added layer of, hey, those colored bits are actually adventurers, and you've got wizards and fighters and clerics. I think that layer, exactly what we were talking about last week, adds a level of clarity rather than adding a level of confusion. You know, it's like, oh, that I understand. I'm going out on a quest, so I need to compile these guys. And where do I get these guys? Well, I take my agent and I put him in a tavern where he can hire these specific kind of guys. So it actually coalesces the idea and makes it clearer rather than obfuscating it further. You know, it's a really beautifully designed game, easy to learn. They have a wonderful YouTube video that you can check out that they actually produced, Wizards of the Coast produced, and the designer of the game narrates, and which will teach you how to play the game, which is great. And they also have a really fantastic iOS version. So when you get hooked on it, and you want to play it when your friends aren't around, you can still keep playing it. So it's an easy game to recommend. And I think I'm really glad that you liked it, Christian, because I think it opens the door for even more complicated, interesting Euros. And you now have a context in which to sort of play those games.
Yeah, I mean, with that said, what was the last, and I had to leave before it was finished, but what was the card game? Genre Smash?
We were playing Smash Up, yeah.
Yeah, and that game, to me, I feel like, is the opposite of everything that you were just saying, where, you know, it has classes, robot, zombies, pirates, ninjas, or whatever, but it kind of felt arbitrary, but at the same time, they didn't want it to be, right? Because, you know, Garnet and I were looking at the cards, and we had to ask, oh, so does every class have similar cards? Oh, no. And you were explaining, and it made sense to you, but I think to Garnet and I, it just seemed so funny. You were like, oh, no, a lot of the cards are kind of within the theme. So, you know, like pirates, of course, they like to move around a lot. And it's like, what does that mean to someone that hasn't played the game? It just sounds confusing. And, you know, the type was really small on the card, and you're trying to look where to play it and trying to understand that robot. So what are robots? They replicate? Is that the thing that they're doing? So you don't have all the cards, but you can try to then, you know, imagine what future cards might be. And it seemed like a game that could be very fun. Again, this is Smash Up.
Smash Up, yeah.
If you understand the card, but I almost feel like I'd want to take the box home with me and study the different characters or different classes for a week, look at all the cards, and then get a handle on the game. And I didn't even think it was fun to sit and play a hand to try to learn the rules, just because in my head, you know, I'm a smart person and I like to play intelligently. I'm trying to picture steps ahead or plan out what I'm going to do, but not knowing the card or knowing the predictability for what I might draw versus a very simple card game, like, not simple, but easy to understand, hard to master, like poker, you know, where you know what the odds are, you know what the deck is, blah, blah, blah. And Smash Up, I didn't have any of that knowledge. So I was almost playing blind, even though I understood the rules of the game.
Yeah. Smash Up is from AEG. It was a big hit in a couple of years ago because it was kind of inexpensive, and it's got a great theme. I mean, as you said, you have these decks, and each deck is themed on a kind of genre geeky archetype. You've got wizards that are sort of like Harry Potter. You've got zombies. You've got aliens. You've got all kinds of pirates and ninjas. And you get to take two of those decks and smash them up and make them into one deck. So you get to combine any two, and you have the selection process at the beginning. You get to make your, you know, dinosaur pirates or your zombie wizards or whatever it is. So you've got elements of both decks in your hand, and then you're trying to play down members of that deck, minions that you've got, to score points at these different bases that are around the table. But I understand how it could be frustrating, and not knowing the combos that you can use in your hand and what the cards do. There's a lot of text on the cards, and there's a lot of just sort of reading it and trying to grok what's going on. So that was not a hit at our game night, but I'm really pleased to say that Lords of Waterdeep was and is an easy game to recommend. Justin, did we get you back?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, yay! Are you a board gamer or not so much?
I like board games a lot, but I don't have a lot of people I play with regularly, so I don't get much opportunity.
Any particular game that you want to mention, or should we move on?
I wouldn't think that I have a lot of interesting things to offer. I mean, I like the same things as everybody. I like your Last Nights on Earth. I like
very good
your
game.
Earths. There's a company called Games by Playdate. They make card games. They just made a card game out of one of my podcasts that I just received today, which
Whoa.
Is really weird. They made a Sawbones card game about
how rad is that?
Medical history. I know, it's super neat. So I haven't opened it yet. So I'm excited to check that out.
Very cool. Congrats on that one. Maybe there will someday be the DLC story of the week game. All right. Well, there's a couple other things I want to hit on. One of which is to talk about the March Madness that we're going to be running. If you heard last week, We're doing March Madness starting next episode on DLC. All the month of March, we have compiled. Actually, you, the great, awesome listeners, sent in your votes all during this whole last week of the games that should compete in our tournament for Champion Video Game. And those have been compiled. If you go to jeffcanada.com, that's with two N's and one T, you can see the bracket. You can download the bracket yourself. You can fill out the bracket and send it in and, you know, decide what you think the results of our head-to-head pairings of all these games will be. It was really fascinating this week compiling all the votes. We got so many people sending in their picks for – some people just sent in a couple games. Some people sent in all 32. It was – every single game on the list got multiple votes. There's a lot of games that got multiple votes that – didn't make the list, which is really interesting to me. I'll just, we'll start doing the head-to-head matchups next week, but I thought it'd be interesting to see what Justin and Christian have to say about do you guys have the list there? If you go to jeffcanada.com, you can see. What do you guys think of some of those matchups? If you click on the bracket, you can see the actual match. It's some pretty intense first round stuff. They were all seeded based on the most votes. So the games that got the highest vote got top seed all the way down to the 16th seed on each division. We got two divisions, the Kanata division and the Spicer division. The number one seed, Christian, I gave you the seed with Last of Us in it, or the division with Last of Us in it, and GoldenEye. I figured those two you would want.
I'm curious how we're going to – I mean, you look at some of these matchups, and like you said, it's on your website. I basically – copied your blog post, put it up on mine so people can find it, and we'll tweet it out, of course, too. I'm curious how these are going to be decided, because you look at some of these. So in your bracket, for instance, 8 and 9 is Halo versus BioShock.
Ouch.
That's tough.
I mean, it's tough, man. Nobody said it was going to be easy, Spicer.
GTA Vice City versus Uncharted 2, Street Fighter 2 versus Pokemon, Red Blue on my side. Like, holy crap. And even some of these that might not be personal favorite games of mine, you know, I have to recognize their merit. And I will certainly be championing some of these games. It's, our work's cut out for us. So listeners, yeah, if you guys have a game that you really, really love, you know, let me know what it is. And more importantly, let me know what games you really, really think Jeff loves on his bracket, and I'll try to make sure that they don't win.
Well, I don't think there's a better head-to-head gaming competition than Red Dead Redemption versus Persona 4. Yeah, I can pick the best of those. No problem.
If people can submit their own brackets, we're gonna give a little award. It may end up being a no prize, but it'll be a something to the person who gets the most accurate bracket submitted. But also, you're gonna want to, if you can at all, you're going to want to listen live all during the month of March, because I'm gonna set up live voting, so you'll be able to vote as we're discussing, so your vote can influence our discussion as to who the winner will end up being. I think this is going to be really fun, and it'll be silly and good times. The number one, by the way, the number one seeds in each division, Super Mario 64 on my side, and The Last of Us actually got the number one seed. It was actually the number two rated voted game overall. And it was really hard because there was a lot of people who were voting on multiple games in a series, you know, so almost every Mario game and almost every Zelda game got at least a couple of votes. So I decided, because Super Mario 64 and Super Mario World were both so highly voted, I put both of those games in. But other games that had multiples in their series, I just kind of boosted the game that had the most votes. I just sort of gave them a boost because of other games in that series. Because I didn't want it to be just a whole bracket full of Zeldas and stuff like that, you know. But I think it's going to be fun, and I think it's going to be hotly debated. So let's take some calls and find out what the people want to hear us talk about. I got a 479 caller. You have a question for Justin or Christian and I?
Sorry, guys. This is Billy from Northwest Arkansas. I have a quick tabletop time question for you, man.
Tabletop time.
As a lapsed tabletop gamer, the ones that I remember loving as a kid were the ones that had like gadgets and stuff. I don't know if you know what Run Yourself Ragged is. That was early 80s, but the things like crossbows and catapults or mousetrap, you know, things that you could build. And don't say Warhammer, but are there any like really awesome tabletop games that kind of feed that, you know, miniature kind of toy type thing that you could do? Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. I mean, the game we talked about last week, I think, is the closest sort of, you know, intense strategic game that scratches that mousetrap itch. And that was Tolkien Mayan Calendar, which has that interlocking gear system, which, you know, rotates your worker placement guy around the board as you play. That was pretty cool. But there's, if you're talking miniatures and you're talking just sort of the toy aspect of board games, there is a ton to choose from. That's the whole genre. I mean, there's the whole miniature side, like you're talking Warhammer and that, not even that. There's a bunch of great looking miniatures games. There's one that I'm really dying to play that's just coming out. It's hard to get at this point, but I've heard really good things about it, called Myth, M-Y-T-H. But there's a whole bunch of great miniatures games. I would check out a company called Fantasy Flight. Fantasy Flight, they sort of hang their hat on creating games that have really great components and really beautiful miniatures. So you're going to find a lot of games in their stable that have those awesome sort of toy-esque miniatures. Either of you guys have anything you want to add to that?
I don't know of any, but I do, man, what was that volcano game that I played when I was little that I loved? Volcano Island? I'm going to Google it.
No, it's we did a whole segment on TRS on it because Dan got an eBay and got a copy. You can't get a copy anymore. It's called Fireball Island.
Yes. Oh, Fireball. My gosh. What a great game.
My jam. Fun. 13 Dead End Drive. You guys remember that one?
No.
That was a game all about this sort of, it was basically a house where sort of a Clue style filled with different traps that the characters would end up in. And so there was like a fireplace that you could drop people into, a chandelier that was hanging off the board that you could drop onto characters if they died, a statue that would fall That's over rad. And knock people over. Sweet.
Oh, another game I'll mention is one of my favorite games for two players, and that's Memoir 44, which is a World War II game. Spectacular game. Really cool. It's got little army men, and the expansions have tanks and all kinds of stuff. And they have real battles. It comes with a booklet of real battles, and the game is modular, so you can transform the terrain and the positioning of all the people on the battlefield to mimic actual battles from World War II. And it has dozens and dozens and dozens. And there's expansions you can buy that have dozens and dozens. And some of the really cool things, there's one where you got your guys parachute in. So the booklet tells you to actually physically drop your dude from a height of 2 feet or whatever. And where he lands on the board is where he starts play. So it as this cool element of, playing with toys, but it's thematic and it's like, yeah, those guys dropped in and that's where they landed. And so here we go, very, very cool game. Again, for two players, it has a different mode, Overlord, I think it's called, where you can put two copies of the game together and add multiple players over two, but it's mostly a two player game. All right, go ahead.
What'd you good. Say? I don't think it wasn't me.
All right. Okay, we've got another caller on the line from 407. Do you have a question for Justin or Christian and I?
Hey, Jeff. Hey, Christian. Hey, Justin. Actually, this is Val again from Florida, third time on the show. I wanted to go back to your guys' discussion about Titanfall, and I guess the question I had for you guys was, the problem for Titanfall, I feel like, is that it's a cross-gen game. It's going to be on 360, and I'm wondering if that's going to hurt its system seller abilities, because you think of system sellers, you think of, Mario 64, Halo, those games were designed specifically for that platform and only for that platform. And the other thing that kind of struck me about Titanfall is that it almost feels like it's the way Mario Kart is for the Wii U, where, this is the game that has come to define the system in a way, but it doesn't use the Kinect, which is the Xbox One's main feature. And I'm wondering and I saw this article on Justin's site, Polygon, about is the Kinect becoming an albatross around the Xbox One's neck the same way the gamepad is for the Wii U?
What do you think, Justin?
The Kinect, it was breaking up a little bit there, Kinect specifically, whether or not that's a...
an albatross around the neck of the...
Yes. I think that the... I think the time is running down on them proving the viability of why everyone needs a Kinect. I think that, certainly it's nice having the option of doing voice commands, et cetera, but I just don't know in terms of video game applications, I don't know why everybody needs one. Certainly not right now at the place we find ourselves at.
Yeah. So do you think it's going to be a problem for Xbox One that Titanfall is available on multiple platforms, and which platform do you think will sell the most copies?
I had a pretty even split between people who were playing the beta on Xbox One and people who were playing on PC. If you're talking about critical mass, though, it seems like you're still going to get the best audience on. I say that, but PC doesn't have the fragmentation that 360 and Xbox One have. I think people who are Xbox gamers may be split between the two, and you're not going to have that on PC. So PC might be the one to go with.
Interesting.
So, anecdotally, I was hanging out with a friend that, you know, doesn't have any insider information into the particulars of Titanfall's development, or EA or Microsoft contracts, but is a knowledgeable person within the industry. And this person thought that there might have been some money exchange slash conspiracy theorying, theorizings of conspiracy, going on regarding the Xbox 360 version of Titanfall coming out 2 weeks later than the PC and Xbox One version. And to me, I kind of believed the was a different development team. They're running behind, so it's going to take 2 weeks. I mean, it has to be either 1 week or 2 weeks. It won't be like the day after because of, you know, release schedules for games and stuff like that. But it was interesting to hear this other person that knows the business, is in the business in some form or fashion, and, you know, like I said, has no knowledge of this particular deal, but thinking that, and it would probably be used as marketing money is the way that those funds would change hands. But do you guys
think that's particularly nefarious, though? I mean, I buy that. They want it to be on the system 2 weeks earlier. Then I don't think that's, you know, I'm not up in arms over it.
I think as EA, that has to be a decent chunk of change, though, because you're willing to delay the version 2 weeks that has the biggest install base. I understand not wanting to show media of it because people might post images incorrectly and it might make your game look bad. But that just seems crazy to me that as a publisher for this big game, that's a big investment. I don't know. I guess I'm willing to believe it, but I still find it shocking that something like that would happen.
I don't know. I don't think it's all that shocking. I think it's pretty, I mean, as soon as I heard it was going to be 2 weeks later, I thought, it's probably because Microsoft was like, hey, put it on our new console first, please. And by please, I mean, here's money.
Interesting.
Let's see if we can bust through a couple calls before we have to wrap things up. I got a call from my neck of the woods, 818. What's up? What's your question?
He's fine.
Hey, guys. It's Brad out in Studio City.
Brad.
Hey, Brad. Yeah. How's it going?
Yeah. You might get a text from me later saying the feed disappeared on the phone line for a while. I was trying to get through and couldn't hear. I was wanting to say back when you were talking about Tony Hawk that what I would actually much prefer is a new Kelly Slater's Pro Surfer. There hasn't been a surfing game really since the PS2. And playing Assassin's Creed 3, or 4 rather, on the PS4, I'm looking at that water and going, oh man, I want a new surfing game.
Oh man, I want a new surfing game indeed. I'm going to go ahead and guess that you two guys think that sounds boring.
No, I love to get up there and shred. As long as it stars Sandy Cohen of the OC, that's a surfing game I could really get into. I've been watching a lot of the OC lately.
I don't know what a surfing game would be. I think there are opportunities for a fun surfing game. Like, I'd never pictured Ollie Ollie being the skateboarding game that I needed or wanted, and I'm still frustrating my way through it and having a great time not completing challenges. But I don't know, you know, Kelly Slate, like, is it, what was it, TNC Surf?
Surf and Skate.
Yeah, TNC that was Surf and Skate. A great challenging surfing mini game in that game. I don't know what a surfing game
Unleashed,
is.
Man. Wakeboarding Unleashed. That's the game I want a sequel to.
If we're just throwing out extreme sport games, and it needs to be aggressive inline, and we need to get Arlo Eisenberg back out, you know, and Chris Edwards, you know, we got to make an Airborne 2 movie while we're at it. If we're just saying dreams, then these are dreams. I don't know what a surfing game is. And so, you know, Jeff, what is it? What is it? So much of surfing is, it's a small run. There aren't tricks. You're not doing jumps. Is it just?
You do tricks. I don't know if you haven't watched tricks on surfing. There's a guy who just did a freaking backflip on surfing for the first time ever in competition, did a backflip.
Was he strapped in or was he not
strapped in? No, not strapped in.
Well, that's cool. What's your surfing game, Jeff? This is going to be the part of the show where you say you're excited about a game and I put you to the wall and make you say what the game is.
I'm not that excited about a surfing game, to be honest with you. I like actually surfing. I like actually surfing, and I think the new water would be cool. But the problem with the surfing game is, like, here's this wave, and then there's that wave, and now there's this wave, and they're all the same. That's a problem.
A papers please type, like, indie game that talks about the harsh realities of surfing. Now, that's a game I could get behind, where you're just sitting there waiting for waves to come in, and you have to just pass on a wave, know that you told your girlfriend or boyfriend that you'd be home in 4 hours, and then rivals from Pike's Point come over, and they challenge you because they're the bird dogs. I don't know, I'm throwing out terms now, of that surf spot. All right.
I'm stopping your riff. We have a hard out today because our producer has to get going. So I want to take one more call. Just cram it right in, see if we can get to it. From 201. We're cramming you in. Hit us with a great question to wrap the show up with. 201. Are you there? Caller.
This is the caller from 201. I just wanted to say that here's the rest of Christian's riff. And the people are...
Whenever I put pressure on it...
And also, he really nailed it with that Japan PS4 release story.
Let's just say that wasn't the caller. That was Justin again agreeing with me. Thanks, Justin.
Hey, I'm Parallel Universe Justin. My call got dropped.
Hey, how was Parallel Universe at midnight? You were a great guest on that.
Yeah, we had a great show. Halbrand is still alive over there, too. So
801, you are on the air. Don't let us down. Do it.
Okay, I know you guys have a hard stop, so I'll make it quick. Good to hear you guys on here. Justin, I'm a big fan. I will admit I've watched part of Time Belt, so I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but congratulations on the new baby coming.
Listen, man, it's so good to hear from you, and yes, I would be happy to be on your show. Sorry to interrupt.
I do have a question, though, about your new baby. Will your new baby, though, be a mutant because of the water in West Virginia? I wonder if that'll somehow... give your baby some X-Men powers or something.
This is an excellent question. Finally, the topics that the people want to know about. You are having a baby.
Yeah. It's a baby.
Your baby.
My baby. I don't actually get my water from the Kanawha River, which was the source of that catastrophe when there was a chemical spill that robbed people of their drinking water for weeks on end. That was... not something that affected me here. So no, I'll be okay.
But what if your baby was a mutant, mm-hmm. what baby mutant power would you want your baby mutant to have?
I hope that my baby has the mutant power to help the people of West Virginia not be so impoverished that it's hysterical when their water's poisoned.
So he craps money.
Superhuman compassion, perhaps.
All right. Well, I can't think of a better way to end the show than that, folks. Justin, it has been a supreme pleasure to have you on the show. You know I am a big fan of yours, and anytime you'd like to return, I would welcome that. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you guys so much for having me here.
You did a lot of great plugging at the top of the show. Would you like to plug at the bottom of the show as well?
Gosh, I hate to double up, but let me just fire up that old engine again. Sawbones and My Brother, Me are two podcasts I do on the Maximum Fun Network. I'm the managing editor of Polygon, a video game website. The best one, I think, is at polygon.com. I have a Twitter feed at Justin McElroy, JustinMcElroy. And that's my whole shtick.
Christian, your shtick, please.
Oh, my shtick. Man, I'm blanking on things, but I should be better about them. If you're listening live and you're in Los Angeles tomorrow, Tuesday, I think I'm doing a show with Jay Moore at the Hollywood Improv, and I'm doing a show with Pete Holmes and TK Kelly called Warp Zone later in the night. That is Tuesday. That's tomorrow. That is the, if you're listening to this live, March is another improv versus stand-up at UCB LA. With Kyle Kinane and Rory Scovel and a great improv team called Belmonte. And then what's new in March at Nerdist is Thomas Dale from Chelsea Lately, Grant Cotter from MTV's Jerks with Cameras, Steve Simone, who has smaller roles and a bunch of stuff. You'll definitely know him if you see him. And it's headlined by Ari Shaffir, who's back in town from New York. That's a fun show and it's free. And you can find it at nerdmeltla.com and RSVP for tickets to that. That's kind of my month, I think. I think that's my March.
Pretty good. I want to remind everybody to get their brackets in. for the March Madness madness that's going to start next week. It's going to be a lot of fun, I think. You can find all the details for that at jeffcanada.com with two N's and one T. I'm about to leave this afternoon, actually, for Palm Springs, where I will be starting up the production of the 39 Steps that I am in. If you happen to find yourself in Palm Springs over the next 2 weeks, please come see it. Everyone that has seen it has loved it, and I'm really proud of it. It's a wild, wacky, incredible stage chaos. And I would like to thank the person who I can't seem to find on Twitter right now, but you know who you are, who sent me the link to the 39 Steps video game, which is available on Steam. That's pretty wild.
You can get it on iPad, too. It's cool.
Is it good?
It's sort of a an interactive novel, I would say. But it's really interesting.
I will have to check it out. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Cannata with two N's and one T. This week on Twitter, Ronald Dymicki said that DLC stands for Discuss, Learn, Contribute, which I think is one of my favorite ones I've heard thus far. We really appreciate you guys listening. Tune in next week, 11 a.m. Pacific time, every week at 5x5.tv/DLC. And until then, think about what you put out into the world, make it a better place.